Hi, I'm Michael Sunoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
Between you and anybody in this world that has more out of life than you do. And keep in mind that when I talk about success, I'm not talking about financial success alone. Everyone doesn't want that. I'm talking about being the best eater, the best preacher, the best doctor, the best housewife, the best lawyer, the best of whatever it is you choose. We sell a course, and you know what this course is? You know what we're selling you? We're selling you nothing. We are selling you nothing. All we're doing is developing what's already in your mind. And nobody wants to buy nothing, and most people think they're nothing. So how can we sell a man himself when he doesn't think much of himself? He'd rather buy an automobile. That's important. He'd rather put $5,000 for Glenn Turner and let him use it because he believes I can do it. But you're not going to get him too easily to invest in nothing. And who says he's nothing? Not I. Not himself. His neighbors and friends have told him all his life that he is nothing.
Hi, this is Michael Sunoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. You've just heard about 1 minute of one of the most powerful speeches I have ever heard in my life. And stay tuned till the very end of this recording, and I'm going to show you how to get this entire 40-minute speech absolutely free. Get ready, because here's one of the most fascinating and enjoyable interviews I've done to date. It's with a gentleman named Glenn W. Turner. Now, if you're over 50, you may have heard of this gentleman, because back in the early 70s, he was like the Tony Robbins of the early 70s. He was a tremendous businessman. He built a tremendous multi-level marketing company called Costcott. There are several books written about him, and he was a motivator and an inspirational teacher. He had operated over 76 corporations under Turner Enterprises. An hour of me going through his life story, you'll hear the tremendous adversities he had from the time he was born to a mega success to the fall of his empire. It's truly a wonderful story, and the lessons he gives are heartfelt, and you can certainly use them in your life and in your business. This is not the kind of interview you can listen to one time. My interviews are packed with content. There's no fluff, and you just got to keep listening to them. So without further ado, let's get going with this exclusive interview only found at Michael Sunoff's HardToFindSeminars.com with Glenn Turner. Enjoy.
Hello.
Good morning, Glenn. Mike Sunoff here.
Hi, Mike.
How are you?
Good.
Good. Glenn, give me just a little bit of your background, your roots. Where did you come from?
I was born in Charity Ward from an unwed mother in Columbia, South Carolina. My mother had a complication of scarlet fever. As a result, it caused me to be born with a hair lip and a clipped palate.
And what year were you born?
1934, August 19th. Makes me 71 and a half years old. And I'm still in good shape. My mother was transported by the county to the hospital. She was unmarried. 7 months later, my father and her got married. He had to leave me in the hospital so they could do the operation on my lip and do the palate pushback. And then about a month later, I came home. For the first 7 months, I lived with my grandmother because my mother went to work as a waitress. And, you know, back in the day, it was a sin and a shame and the worse it is now to be born without a father. Then I was raised on a tobacco farm in Marion, South Carolina. And I dropped out of school in the 8th grade. and I went into the Air Force when I was 17 years old.
Yeah, why'd you drop out of school?
Well, the people making fun of my hair lip was my main excuse, and my father and mother weren't too educated, so they couldn't help me, you know. Kids made fun of me, and I was always getting in fights. And then I went into the U.S. Air Force at 17 years old with my father signing the paper, and I got a stay for 1 year in the Air Police, but I got a perforated eardrum. I had it when I went in, I didn't catch it. And they discharged me, went in 1 year, medical discharge. And then I went to the opportunity school on G.I. Bill. Opportunity school was run by a 72-year-old lady named Dr. Willard Gray. And Dr. Willard Gray was an old maid, come from a rich family, that started a school for people that dropped out of high school to come back and get their high school diploma.
How'd you find out about it?
Well, the state employment office in my hometown, Mrs. Leighton, was trying to get me a job. She said, you're not going to qualify for anything. You don't have no education. And I was 18. And I had the GI Bill. She knew about the school. It was operated by Dr. Gray. Later, the school was given to the state of South Carolina. I donated a $150,000 scholarship fund to the school when I got rich.
And she would bring in kids and train them?
Privileged kids and people that slow in school, and even adults that were 30, 40 years old that had missed their high school and wanted to come back and get a diploma.
Did that experience influence you to be so generous and give back to the community?
Yeah, and Dr. Willard Gray changed my life. You got to realize she was somebody. I was fortunate to be her chauffeur 2 months one summer, and I chauffeured her around the state, and I went to go into politicians' office and governor's office and ask them for funds for the school. And the old Air Force base in Columbia was donated to her for private school to barracks and everything. It changed my life. Otherwise, I would have been pumping gas to the gas station if it hadn't been for her.
What do you remember? What did she tell you?
She told me, where will you be 10 years from today? She said, you're going to be married to some overweight woman with 10 children on a tobacco farm pushing a plow. Scared the dickens out of me. I was afraid to look at a girl like for a while there.
You didn't want to be growing up on a tobacco farm?
No, because I always knew in the bottom of my heart that I was wealthy, money-wise and attitude-wise. And I used to make a lot of jokes to get people to laugh with me and not at me, like a lot of comedians do. So I would do all kind of stuff to entertain people and be funny. And when I got out of the opportunity school, I went to the University of Houston for a diesel engineer mechanic course, but I didn't last about 6 months. I dropped out because I decided I didn't want to be greasy. So I went into door-to-door sales of sewing machines.
How'd you first find that job?
Well, a guy came out of my mama's house and sold her a sewing machine, and I was against her buying it because it cost $150. We didn't have that kind of money. So at that time, we lived in a house with an outhouse out back and all that.
Was this like when sewing machines first came out?
Yeah, they were selling Japanese machines. You got to realize this is in 1952, and the Japanese were starting to put machines, and everybody was against anything the Japanese made because of the war, you know. And so I came in, the guy had mom and daddy all sold on buying the sewing machine, and I started getting negative, talking about it, and he looked at me and says, boy, you are a one-built kid. Said, where'd you get all them muscles? I said, I'm a weightlifter. And I had won the third place in Mr. South. 1952. So, make a long story short on that issue. He bragged on me so much, he sold me, and then I said, well, go ahead and get it, Daddy. I'll contribute half the money to it. Put the mash on me, as I call it. After he left, my mama said, Glenn, you'd be a good salesman. You can do what he did. Had a brand new station wagon. He probably made $40 sale on that commission, which more than I made all week. And so I went and ran 200 miles away with my old black Ford that I paid $125 for, selling sweet potatoes door to door. And saved the money. And I went to work, and in the next 2 years, I had 27 cars repossessed from me. I was fired by the same boss 26 times.
Did you contact that salesman or the office where he came from?
No, I saw it in the paper. It was a different company than he was with. My attitude was such up and down, I didn't have any confidence about being a salesman, and I dropped out of the sales.
So you went and you said you were going to give it a try, and you got the job, right?
The first advertised for sewing machine mechanics, $75 a week. And I went in there, and he said, you're a salesman, boy. I said, I can't even talk to me. What are you talking about? So there's a movie on my life that tells the whole story, and it shows this scene. But basically, I went to work, and I'd fail, and I'd try, and I'd fail, and I'd try, and it took me 2 years to learn how to do it and make a living at it.
Do you have any mentors back then to help you along the way to teach you sales?
Yeah, a fellow named Jim Durham. He was 20 years old when I was 21.
He was another salesman?
Yeah, he was raised with Elvis Presley, same high school. He was a manager at 20 years old, which impressed me. He saw the potential in me. Of course, he had nothing to lose. I was on freight commission, you know.
Yeah, what was the commission back then?
Well, if you sell a $200 sewing machine, you make $25.
Why were women buying sewing machines back then? Because they could make their own clothes, and it just saved them time other than using the needle and thread?
Yeah, they had the treadle. The people were getting out of the treadle, and Singer was higher. It was $300, $400, and I was about half price. We had a 25-year guarantee for parts and labor.
Were you going on qualified appointments, or were you knocking on doors cold?
We'd advertise on radio. And once you make the most words out of Thanksgiving, we get a free sewing machine. Everybody else was a runner-up, got a $50 discount. So we'd go out and bang on the door and say you would enter the contest. You didn't win the grand prize, but you get a discount. So we'd give them a discount. Of course, just like an automobile deal, they'd give you a discount.
So at first you weren't that successful, but you stuck with it for about 2 years, and then you really got the hang of it?
I got the hang of it and started opening my own business and had two or three businesses, and I failed a couple times in my own business.
What was your own business, selling?
Selling sewing machines. And then finally, one day, a 19-year-old kid come into town. He was selling Holiday Magic distributorship.
Holiday Magic?
Multi-level, yeah.
Was this the first time you ever heard of multi-level?
Yep. First time I ever heard of attitude, goal setting. First time I had heard of Thank You, Grow Rich, the book.
What was Holiday Magic selling?
Cosmetics.
Okay. Was that one of the first MLMs?
That was the first one I went in. That was the first. It was very big, and I went in and made $250,000 the first 8 months.
You met this guy, and he pitched you on it, and you signed up as a distributor. What did you have to do to become a distributor back then?
I had to come up with $5,000, which I mortgaged my furniture, my mama's furniture, and my sister's furniture.
What was the product?
Cosmetics.
Cosmetics, okay. So you became a distributor, and then you had to figure out, well, how am I going to sell this stuff?
Yeah, I had to get some girls selling, and then I had to set up other franchises, with franchises called distributorship.
Did they have good training in the organization that gave you a lot of your confidence?
Not really. Zig Ziglar was with him at that time.
Oh, really?
And he had a training class, but I told him I didn't have time to go to it because I was making $30,000 a month.
How did you basically build that company?
I just became a public speaker and told a lot of jokes. People had a $2,500 commission on a $5,000 check. So I'd take people to a meeting and put on the board how much they could earn on a sales force.
But where did you get all that confidence from, a not much confidence salesman selling sewing machines all the way to public speaking? Where were the influences there in between that time?
Well, it wasn't anyone. I was scared to death. But the point is, people liked my jokes. I knew how to talk to people, and I like people, and I don't have a prejudice against any race or women or men, whoever does the job. So I was just selling jokes, and I started reading Thank You, Grow Rich, and I started coming up with some positive sayings. When you throw dirt, you're going to lose ground, stuff like that. Next thing you know, I made $250,000, and I took $5,000 of it, and 8 months later, I went in business for myself. First month, I did $67,000.
Okay, so Holiday Magic was your first experience in MLM. You had a great success with it. Did you become one of the number one distributors?
I was number one, and I didn't know it. They told me Ziglar was number one. I was trying to catch him. I'd already passed him.
Zig Ziglar was number one?
Well, they said that. I was trying to pass him. They lied to me.
So a lot of people in MLM hope that they're going to get lucky and get a guy like you under them to make them all the money. That wasn't the case with you.
No, I had nobody under me that made me rich. I had to do it myself. Later when I opened my own business, I had a lot of them.
So you found that the success came from doing the meetings and speaking to a lot of people.
Yeah. See, I always helped a man make his money back, then I dropped it. If he didn't make it out of that, it was tough luck. Because you can't hold them up forever. My theory is, why let a guy you brought in last week talk to a new person by himself and blow the sale because he don't know what he's talking about? Just like why let a new guy that's going to a mechanic shop just got hired in work on your car without a mentor.
So your philosophy when you brought a new distributor in?
Help them get their money back. And then they should be trained. About 30% of them will make it.
You left Holiday Magic and you went off on your own with Costcott. Did you lose your royalty checks because you went out on your own?
I had a partner originally when I first started, and I really got in to help them save their money. They got in, couldn't make it work, and I helped them make it work. And then I gave the distributorship to them. They let it go down. They were drawing $10,000 a month.
Did you have a warehouse with Holiday Magic at that time?
No, I didn't have it. I walked down to my house. Second month in Costcott, I did $147,000.
So why'd you leave Holiday Magic?
Well, I was telling too many jokes in front of the room, and they told me to quit telling jokes.
Why is that?
I don't know. I never figured out. Anyway, they lost a fortune.
See, and you said, screw it, I'm going to do my own thing.
I said, I can do my own thing. 22 people left Holiday Magic and went with me to get started. 1 year later, there were 7 of them that are still with me, earning better than 10,000.
So who helped you get it all set up? I mean, to start a multi-level back then, you didn't have the computers, did you?
No, I hired a guy named Lynn Burge who said he was present material. It turned out he didn't know what he was doing. By that time, I was doing it. I operated out of my briefcase to start with.
Was it a sophisticated download payout or just basically a direct sales type thing?
You sign someone up for $2,000, give them $2,000 worth of cosmetic retail, and then they had to pay $2,500 to get a release from the person that trained them. So basically, they had $4,500 involved. You had a commission structure, and everybody that recruited somebody had to leave you one. The first guy you recruited, you left to me, and I made the commission.
Back then, what was going on with the MLM laws?
Well, there was no laws covering what we were. Started stabbing at us, trying to make the law fit. We'd beat them in court, beat them in court, beat them in court.
Were they stabbing at Holiday Magic even during that time?
Yeah, they stabbed at Holiday Magic a little bit.
All right, so Costcott, you built that thing pretty fast, right?
Yeah, first year I did $3 million, second year $33 million. $13 million was reorder business.
$13 million of that $33 million was reorder business.
Well, it means that they sold their first product and wanted more.
Yeah, that's great. That's very good.
If it had left me alone, I'd have been the biggest company in the world. You got to realize Avon was paying 35%. We were paying 65%, so they had to stop me.
Was Avon MLM at that time or just direct sale?
No, they sell direct sales. I think they bounced back for it. But Avon was only paying 35 cents to the girls. We were paying 65 cents. Therefore, they were floating on their yachts, the owner. Necessarily a big, great drop out down in Florida, shaking them up. I paid $12 million legal fees over a period of 5 years. I could have bought half the centers in Washington for that if I didn't know what I was doing. When I was young, and in just 5 years' time, I was a multimillionaire. The second year, I was worth $100 million.
What's the tragedy?
Probably my wife died in 1960. She had cancer, 21 years old. I was 26, but a 19-month-old baby boy.
So how many kids you got?
7 now. Married 4 times.
How many grandkids you got?
Yeah, 7.
All right, that's great. Let's go back to Holiday Magic. This is your first taste of big money, right?
Right.
Tell me what that's like.
$27,000 my second month. Yeah, checks were coming in like $9,000 one day. $3,000 sales give me $7,500.
What do you do with all that kind of money? Do you put it back into the business?
I bought a new Eldorado Cadillac. I got the biggest home in Marion, South Carolina. The deputy sheriff came out and said, you're going to hell for telling people you're making them rich. I was telling people that we're going to make it. We're going to get out of the hick town. And the deputy sheriff said, you're running bootleg whiskey. You're not selling cosmetics. I'm going to catch you before it's over. You might as well give up now.
Were you getting scared?
No, I wasn't scared. The preacher came out and said, liars go to hell, and we need to pray about this, Glenn. Now the preacher turned out to be a liar because I got rich, and I've estimated over 800 million.
So what's the lesson? Why is it that when someone has a great success, there's so much negativity and animosity?
If somebody is less educated than they are, or they feel like they're superior to the person doing the success, they try to stop it or they criticize it because it makes them say, I need to be doing more myself. So it's a matter of you've got to quit doing more. You either got to get greater, you don't know how. They were the bankers, they were the lawyers, they were the senators in my hometown. Newspaper man. Here's a hair-lip, eighth-grade dropout peddling soda machine door-to-door, and all of a sudden he's rich. You draw your own conclusion. And me, when somebody's rich and they live in my hometown, I go shine their shoes, tote their briefcase, find out how they got that way. They say, well, I'm a banker. It's below me to sell cosmetics.
With Costcott, as it was growing, did you hire a law firm?
I hired a couple of lawyers locally first, and I had in-house lawyers, and then Effley Bailey became one of my attorneys, which was a mistake because they were after him more than they were me.
They were after him back then?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a book. I made the poster on inspectors look like Keystone Cops. It's called For the Defense.
Did he have that book published back then?
Yeah, before he got with me. He's the one that got Sam Shepard off. You know who Sam Shepard was?
Yes, yes.
Maybe he's one of the most brilliant men I've ever met. He's the most honest man I've ever met. He worked with me the first year for nothing.
How old was he then?
At that time, he was about 39.
Did you ever keep in touch with him over the years?
Not lately, but I talked to him a couple, 3 years back. He lived in West Palm Beach now.
So when did you really start feeling the heat with Costcott?
About 8 months after I started in August 67 in May and March, the state of North Carolina accused me of being a lottery. And what happened, we found out later, is two of the Attorney General's nephews had got into Coscott and it didn't work, and they wanted the money back, we didn't give it back to them. See, if I'd have known what I know now, I could give everybody's money back to complain. Wouldn't have had no bad publicity. And also, I could have bought some influence in Washington, and I could have got a lobbying firm. But I thought all that was crooked.
Were you traveling all over the country?
I was in 3 states a day on a Learjet. Yeah, Thursday through Sunday.
Who organized all your meetings and everything? You were going through the distributor?
Well, I got a sales manager, which became the president later. And then we had 3 divisional presidents, like 3rd United States East Division. Then we had 15 regional directors on the divisional, which we had in charge of roughly 3 states apiece. California had one because it's big, and Ohio and New York and Florida. And then I had state leaders. We had about 70 of them because some states were bigger.
Had to have a good team in place because I'm sure you learned as you went on, but that's a big organization to handle.
Yeah, well, what we did, we'd make one phone call on Monday morning and we'd know what was how many sales were made down to Pocatello, Idaho. Everybody called the upline.
Were you using computers and sending printouts?
We had a 360 computer that printed the checks out. It was one of them big deals where you had to have an air-conditioned room just right. It cost me $40,000 a month at least a computer from IBM. But we were modernized. We had a 220,000 square foot building size of 2 football fields.
Give me some stats on Coscott in relationship to the MLM industry. At that time, was Coscott the biggest, the best? What can you tell me about that?
At that time, we were bigger than Amway and bigger than everybody. 63. They started 4 years before me. They were smarter than me. They got Gerald Ford on their side when he was in Congress. And then they were from Michigan. Gerald Ford was from Michigan. And then they were 10 years older than me, where I was 33 years old. They were 43. So they were much smarter men than I were, and they knew how to play the political game.
What was the founder's name?
DeVos.
Were they attracting heat, too?
They got some heat, too. But when they got heat, they got Bob Hope and General Haig on the advisory board. They had clout.
When you get big like that, what's the lesson?
You better have some political people on your side.
How do you do that?
Well, I didn't do it.
How did they do it?
You got to donate to the right campaign and lobbying firms and all that. But I thought that was crooked. So I built a big home in the shape of a castle, 15,000 square feet over an acre. I always had a dirt road because I wouldn't give the commissioners of the county for an extra $20,000. I felt just because I was rich could afford to pay another $20,000, I shouldn't be better than my neighbors. I said, you're stupid. Pay the $20,000, get the road paved, your property will go away. I said, that's not right. And my bailiff told me one time, I said, your problem is you're so honest, you're unreal, nobody believes it. He said, if you weren't honest, you would have been in South America or Switzerland or Ireland with the money. You wouldn't have built your home here, your building here, your buying land here. If I thought I was doing something wrong, I wouldn't have stayed here.
Now let's go into the Dare to Be Great. How did that all start?
Started Dare to Be Great because I called Earl Nightingale, and I asked him would he be my motivator. And I asked Zig. Zig said, I don't think he's going to make the sport.
Why did he say that?
Well, he wrote in his book I was the best salesman he ever had. He thought I was a good salesman, but he said running a business is a little different from being a salesman. And he's probably right, but see, I was too dumb to know he was right. And what I did is I hired people smarter than me to run things.
Did Earl Nightingale come on board?
No, he had made a contract with Holiday Magic, so he couldn't represent both of them.
You know, I just did an interview with Vic Conant of Nightingale Conant about 2 weeks ago.
Good man.
His stuff was just incredible.
Yeah, well, Clement Stone helped that.
Did W. Clement Stone help him out?
Yeah, he's the one that made him famous.
Oh, really?
Yeah, put up the funds for that, Rick. I met Clement on television, that's why they're in the book.
How did Clement Stone get him going?
Put up the money.
He put up the money to get Earl Nightingale, what, on radio?
No, the Nightingale Conant.
Oh, to get Nightingale Conant?
The tape program.
Oh, I got you. Well, I asked Vic Conant, so was Nightingale and Conant 50-50, and he said it was.
Yeah, but Clement Stone was the man that had a magazine. I forgot the name of the magazine that they all branched off of. Clement Stone was 17 years old when I met him. He was worth $300 million that time. He started off in insurance, door-to-door in China shoes.
All right, Dare to Be Great. So how did this all come about?
Well, Dare to Be Great, we needed something to train the people. Coscott is reaching its limit for distributorships. We only wanted one day of a 7,000 population. So we started Dare to Be Great because people were fascinated with the attitude we had. And so we come up with a 9-day course. I took one of the men named Clyde Cobb, who was a nuclear engineer, 28 years old at that time. And I told Clyde to write me a course with 12 takes. So he wrote one on goal setting, attitude, relationship with people, stickability, different subjects. We now have 138 audio tapes. And and we have 38 videos. But Clyde Cobb wrote the first chord, and Dr. Jess Beru wrote the second chord. He was miserable, captain in the Israel Army.
Did the second one replace the first one?
No, we just had additional information. The second chord was how to understand others, work with them, relate to them, and work around the problem, and you know, do what you want. And we had step number three, which was the sales course. I did most of that. And step number four was how to be a leader, leadership. And we had a 9-day class, 8 hours a day. We paid a commission. We sold a course for $300, $1,000, $2,000, each one cost a little more. Total package of $5,000 back in 1969, which is like $25,000 today. We did $300 million sales with Todd Scott and Dare to Be Great both. Great did $189 million of it.
Was Dare to Be Great just an additional product line for the Todd Scott distributors or a separate company?
It was a separate company. But the Todd Scott people left. Some of them would go into that. You had the promoters and you had the retailers. You had the people that set up the gas station and the guy that pumped the gas, in other words. So Todd Scott people, the promoters, wanted to still promote when we closed out the distributorship. Jumped over there to be great, and their wives ran the Cosmetic retail part.
Tell me the advantages. You have a cosmetic product, and you have now an information product. What did you like better from a business standpoint?
The information, because we built men. The product was people. I got over 800 millionaires I know about, and they were pole climbers. They were housewives. They were dishwashers. The unbelievable store, Twin Dwarfs, 33 inches tall, they're going to be freaks in a circle, became millionaires. And didn't become millionaires selling my courses. They became millionaires with the attitude we gave them in the training.
So those courses changed lives.
Exactly right. See, here I am talking to you, Mike, and I said, Mike, if a hair lip 8th grade dropout can become a multimillionaire, why can't you? You got an education, Mike? You got a college degree? If you don't have a college degree, well, I don't either. So what you hang up now? It's unreal. Somebody I told could be great. Somebody said, you're lying to them. Everybody can't be great. I said, some of the fools believe in they get great.
With the cosmetic, you had residual reorders because it has to be used up and bought again. But the information product is pretty much a one-time hit, or you have other products that people buy. How would you compare those?
Well, they were Dare to Be Great, and then they sold other products. I had 78 corporations before it was over.
Gee, 78 corporations?
Under one umbrella, Turner Enterprise. A coffee factor, I had a tree-shaking machine, I had a professional football team.
What football team?
Orlando Panthers. It was a Continental League. It lasted about 3 years. We were the number one team in 10 teams.
Now, how old were you then?
35.
How do you handle 78 different companies?
Well, we had 9 divisional presidents. They divided the 78 under each one of them. It was a system just like you run a grocery store.
Yeah, good organization.
Yeah. And I had terrific salespeople and I had terrific administrators at that time.
Were you a workaholic?
Yeah, I went day and night. Half a million miles a year, I flew on a Learjet, my own private jet. I had 14 aircraft.
Yeah, did you have young kids at that time?
Yeah, my wife took care of them. I would come home. It's not how much time you spend with a kid, it's the quality. When I was playing with my little daughter 3 years old, I was laying on the floor with the dolls and the dollhouse for half an hour. An hour quality playing time, better than heading around yelling at her all week. Not the time you spend with your men, and the same with my executive. Most people sit there and jaw and tell joke for 30 minutes and say what you're going to say in 10 minutes and get out of there.
So you're a believer, no wasting time.
No, I simply hired a man. If he made a mistake, I gave him another chance. If he made 3 mistakes, I got rid of him. And I usually promoted him up and out. And if a guy left me because he did something wrong, I usually paid him 3 months' salary. But I paid him 30 days from now, 60 days from now. So by that time he had another job, he wasn't bitter. Otherwise, he tells everybody all the problems.
The village where anything is possible. What's that about?
That was a castle. 60 acres, $300,000 it cost me. Spent $4 million on building the castle. Never been completed. Got about 80% finished. The government moved in. Finished the boathouse. It helped 200 people upstairs. Had a stable I lived in a while. Had 7 bedrooms and up above the horses. Later, I kicked the horses out and made more bedrooms and more space. Had a treehouse that cost $15,000 for the kids to play in. Had a gatehouse. Had 30 security guards in the building and the airport.
Did you bring distributors there to tour it or anything?
Yeah, I brought people out there. I built it for that reason. And we had barbecues. We had our army barracks in Sanford, Florida, right out of Orlando, where we trained them how to be positive. We had translated equipment for 5 languages, just like the UN. We trained 600 women there a week. You get the women fired up, the husband has to go or she's leaving.
So when you're selling an opportunity, it's important to sell the wife.
you got to remember that whoever's in the house besides the one you're selling, you want to sell them too, but they can open their mouth and kill the sale. I had seven women present back in 72 that all made me $1 million that year. Every one of them, maybe 2 million. Black woman, 27 years old, was former maid, unheard of. She's with Uniform Stores of America now. A top man under Lyndon Johnson, bank commissioner. He came down here and wanted me to federal charter, a bank charter. And I said, I don't know anything about the bank. He said, if you'll just give us $200,000, we will set you up, make sure you have no legal problems, get you the right lawyer, they have a law firm. And I said, man, that's crooked. That's like mafia. I'm not going to pay you to do that.
So he wanted you to get a bank charter, basically buy protection?
He was going to give me a bank charter if I buy protection.
And what would a bank charter allow you to do?
I'd own the biggest bank in Central Park. I was running about $18 million a month through the bank. I said, that's crooked. See, I had a warped sense of what's crooked, but that's the way business is done. See, I just got rich too fast, and I didn't know what I was doing.
Did you have any mentors who are already in big business to help?
I didn't trust them because they're all crooked. And I figured they'd take my company away from me.
Okay, so U.S. Senate, what's that about?
I ran for the Senate.
What made you decide to do that?
Well, I was in between two mail fraud trials. The first trial lasted 8.5 months, and then a hung jury. The second trial lasted about 2.5 months, and I defended myself, and I beat them so bad. They were settled for misdemeanor.
Were you totally stressed out?
No. At that time, I was young and dumb and full of piss and vinegar.
Who was defending you on the first one? Did you have a decent lawyer?
Ed Garland in Atlanta, Georgia. I did a better job when I did in the second trial.
On the first one, what state was it with?
I had a hung jury, so they retried. In between the two trials, I ran for the Senate. The reason I ran for the Senate, they had a gag rule on me where I couldn't talk about what was going on in the trial. And so as a U.S. Senator candidate, I could say anything I wanted to about the settlement, John.
And were you able to voice?
Oh, I voiced like you wouldn't believe.
Where were you able to talk about it now that you were running for Senate?
Well, when I was campaigning. Then I said, when I get to Washington, I'm going to be like the fox in the hen house. The chickens are going to run. I should have kept my mouth shut and got the Senate. I came in fourth in the Democratic primary at 11 candidates, which one of them was the president of the Senate, one of them the president of the Florida Bar Association. I whipped them pretty good because I had name recognition in my own home county. I came in second only to the Secretary of State at that time.
How much did you have to spend on the campaign?
I didn't have a $30,000. It froze all my money by then.
Oh, they had all your money frozen?
And my opponents had $500,000.
Were your companies frozen at that time?
They were in Chapter 11.
Okay, both your companies were in Chapter 11.
I turned it over to a preacher who beat me out of them later. $13 million down the drain.
Tell me about the day that you realized everything was frozen and was going down. Where were you?
Well, it was gradually.
How long did it take from the time the heat started till everything was frozen and that was done with your two companies?
Well, 5 years.
It took that long?
Yeah. You got to realize one thing. Money was never my option. Money just gets people excited. And after I get them excited, I get them and then I teach them how to be happy, how to handle problems. There's a great course. People use that long after they lost money or they made money. Because if you got your attitude right, you can make it. And it was the fun of doing it more than it was getting it. Realize I was born naked. If I died naked, I've lost nothing. I've just borrowed everything in between. Mail fraud was when they indicted me.
All right, so they indicted you. What did they do, just fine you?
They indicted me, and then I won the trial. We settled with them.
Oh, I see. So it was just a monetary settlement?
Yeah, $2,500.
That's it?
After they changed all the laws. See, they kept me busy with the court system until they changed the laws. There was no laws. Violating no laws because everything I was doing was legal in those days.
But what did they indict you on if there were no laws?
The environment of mail fraud. They can take you and if you send me a letter saying I'm going to slap the crap out of Joe down the street, they can indict you.
Okay, so they used a vague mail fraud law to indict you.
Right. And they have a 97% conviction rate.
Okay, so you settled. Then what did you do at that time?
Well, I went back and I started another company called Mind Spa. Just a smaller version of it. It'd be great.
And what did you do different this time?
Well, I didn't have the multi-level part.
It was just direct sales?
Yeah, and then later I went into a company. My bodyguard, Ed Rutgers, who wrote one of the books about me. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't multi-level, so it was just direct sales. How did that go?
Went good. Nothing like multi-level. Later we went into multi-level with him owning a company called Challenge America. That's the one they finally got me for aiding the bed and the pyramid, and I spent 4 years and 8 months in Arizona prison.
You started another multi-level, but you did it through some other guy, another entity?
Well, I didn't start it. They started, and they used my material.
But they came after you and said you were basically the...
I spoke to the two or three meetings in Arizona. This consumer protection head of America Every year they vote in one of his sisters to turn it down because of reputation. So he wanted to get Glenn Turner to show him he was tougher than everybody else. And I was over here running for state senate, and I didn't take it seriously. So I went out there, and when they ran me through it, the jury wanted to get out for the 4th of July, and they convicted me.
Okay, and then you had to go away then?
4 years and 8 months. It was supposed to be 7 years, but good behavior.
So you were there a whole 4 years and 8 months?
Yeah.
And where were you, in Arizona?
Southeast corner of Arizona.
That was a federal penitentiary?
No, it's state.
Oh, was that guy operating in Arizona?
Yeah, he's operating all 50 states in Arizona, the only one that gave him big trouble. There's so many different laws in each state. He went out there and asked them if they do anything wrong. He said, yeah, I am. Please tell me, I'll change it. They said, you ain't doing nothing wrong. And later they hit him.
You know, I interviewed a guy who made $100 million just about 7 years ago. He made $100 million selling the male enhancement supplements. And the only trouble he had was Arizona, and that's where he went away, in Arizona.
Yeah, well, different states. Wisconsin was bad. Michigan was bad. North Carolina and Arizona. I was in 13 countries.
How old were you then when you went away?
I was 53, and I got out at 58.
What was that experience like?
The biggest problem was I lost my family over it. My wife and then my children, of course, they all came back later. I kind of liked it in a way. I hate to say this, but I was handling the guards, and I was handling the warden, and I was handling the other prisoners, and I was using my philosophy, and I had no problem. You know, where everybody else getting mad at the guard, I'd give the guard a serious compliment.
You just treat them well.
I just doing the others you had them doing to you, and I had respect, and they called me Mr. Turner. No problem in men, but I'd pick out the toughest guy in the yard. It was a Mexican, the toughest guy. It was a black guy. The guy was a white guy, and I respect them for who they were, and they looked after me. I wouldn't tell them where I lived when I got out.
Were you able to work on any business while you were there?
No, I wasn't. I didn't do anything that while I was there. It was kind of a relief to be there. It banged me so hard, so long. All of a sudden, I had free security I didn't have to pay for. I had free meals.
In the other interview I did with this guy who went away, he said the same thing. He went away for about a year. He says it was really kind of a relief. You know, you didn't have the business pressure.
Well, you knew it would be over. But they indicted me in 1955, and it was 2 years before they tried me. I mean, I starved. I had lost everything, lost my home. Everything but one home and all that.
For 2 years?
I couldn't travel out of state. It handicapped me.
Well, what did you do for those 2 years? Was it just the legal stuff and the trials?
Sat around, did nothing. Read books.
Did you get depressed?
No, I was just bored crap.
So you kept a good attitude, pretty much?
I always had a good attitude. I was just bored.
Did you keep in touch with any of your old business associates or anything?
They had company. When I got indicted, I backed out and didn't help them because my name, it was indicted, would hurt them. And then both of them just couldn't keep it going like I had it going.
I read the Time article. When did they do that piece on you?
72, I believe. The Life magazine, left page spread.
I saw the article on Time.
Well, Time had one, too. But in 72, somewhere around the spring, I believe. Also, in 72 is when the article appeared in the New York Times showing I was number 4 on Nixon's hit list. They were after me in all phases. Here is change commission wanted to stop. That'd be great.
Did you get letters while you were in jail?
Got over 12,000.
That must have been nice.
Warden said, who are these people? They're some kind of scam me around. I said, they're my victims.
What happened after that?
Well, I got out. I had 1 year of probation and moved in with a preacher friend of mine. Went through a divorce. Remarried. Started a nutrition company. Been going now for 12 years, mail order. Lately, I've been doing some sales training for Guaranteed International Travel Company.
Do you think the government still has their eye on you, or pretty much old news?
You're the only one that's asked in 10 years about my problem. I probably shouldn't have had it republished.
Return of the Unstoppable American. When did you write the Turner book?
When I got out in 82.
Can we talk about a little bit of stuff that you teach some of your distributors, just some of the personal development stuff? And you've got here total life power. What's that mean?
Well, we work on the spiritual development. I always say, you see that halo around my head? They said, no, I don't see it. I said, you don't have one. But you got to get your spiritual life intact. That means you and your God, not my church, and your church. I respect all religions and all churches. And then you got to do a second thing is your mental. You got to work on your mental attitude, mental excellence, I call it. You got to clean it out before you put it up, because if you don't think right, you're not going to be right.
You know, some people have just such negativity ingrained in them.
You associate with positive people. You read positive books. Whatever you put in the mind the most comes out the mouth. If you put it in Spanish, you're going to speak Spanish. If you're born in Russia, you'd be a communist 20, 30 years ago. If you're born there now, you have a different philosophy, maybe. So So it's whatever you put in your eyes and ears, whatever you put in your mouth makes your body good, bad, shape, cancer, or whatever is going to happen. So you teach people to be careful who they listen to. You cuss me out here on this phone, my first thing would say, well, bye. He was so nice up to the end. Or if you turn this article into a bad article, I said, boy, he slick talked me. Take it personally, I'd say, well, that's his point of view. If I was you, I'd do what you're going to do. So we teach you how to control your mind, not let other people control it. If I can make you mad for 1 minute, I control you. If I can make you mad for an hour, if I can make you mad for a day, a week, a month, a year, if I can make you recall what I did to you 10 years ago, I still got control of your mind to a certain extent. So we learned to take back your mind, because most people lost it when they were 2 years old, when their mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, teachers, and start telling them what to good do and what to good not do.
But it takes work, right?
Sure it does. It takes work to mess it up. If you lived around people that talk about cutting people open, doctor talk, you'd have the mind of a doctor. You live around people that write it, you talk about writing, punctuation, whatever you do there. Same mechanics you talk about. If you live around drug addicts, you talk about the drug. Then you have your emotional control. That's your third thing in the book, in the back of the book.
Now, how's that different from mental?
Emotional is when I can get you upset. Mental, I can feed you wrong information. But emotionally is, well, you just don't know what happened. My husband beat the hell out of me. You just don't know what happened to me when I was a little boy. I was raped. You got to puke it out. We've all had problems. Emotional is the hardest one to work on to get it situated, but it can be done. And then you have physical. Take care of your body. Care what you put in your mouth. Watch what salt does to your body. White flour.
Were you lifting weights when you were younger?
Yeah, I was Mr. South.
So you were pumping iron back then?
Yeah, I pumped iron up until I was about 25, and I just walked down, exercised 3-4 times a week.
Did Charles Atlas influence you?
No, it was Joliet.
Joliet?
Yeah. And he was advertising in the paper like Charles, and he had a course for $79.95, and I couldn't afford it. He sent me in the mail. I'm a little farm boy. My daddy made $500 a year. And then he sent me another $39.95, and next week he came down to $14.95. I had $14.95, but I waited until I got it $7.95. $14.95 bought me some cement, made me some iron weights and cement block, and never started smoking, never drank, and never had drugs in my life. Never touched a cigarette, never touched a whiskey. Well, I'm so excited. If I took that stuff, I'd be jacked up about it. I'd do it too good. I'm high on life, drunk on attitude. And then last but not least is financial power. That's the last chapter in the book. Take care of your money. For example, I know a guy that put up $1,000 in 68 in mutual funds, and it's worth $88,000 last year.
How do you protect your money? Let's say you've got people listening to this, and they're growing businesses, and they're starting to make some good money.
You had to set up a trust, which I did not do. I did it all wrong, because I thought legally I was okay, because I wouldn't do anything wrong with my heart.
Would a trust have protected you?
If you set up the right trust for your children or something, then you're protected. They got all kind of trust. Yeah, you have a trust lawyer.
What other advice would you give businessmen who are growing pretty large companies to protect themselves?
That means they got to hire the right law firm. It's a business law firm, because it's all geared around the law. And I thought all I had to do was go into court and be honest, and they'd be all right, but it's not that way. There's no saying don't let the truth mess up a good story.
Did they want your money?
For the publicity. They wanted to be a guy that got Jesse James. They made a Jesse James out of it so they could ruin him.
What was the largest crowd you ever spoke to?
2,000.
50,000?
In India.
In India?
And 15,000 in America. That's not counting. I won the American of the Year award. The North and South college students, the best of each, plays each other. And the Lions Club of Tampa gave me an American of the Year award on national television. It was 45 million watching. It was about 20,000 there in person.
What's it like speaking? You were speaking in India, 50,000?
Yeah, you're speaking to one person. The rest of them can listen.
How did you prepare for your speeches?
I never prepared.
You went out there and just ad-libbed it?
Before I go up there, I feel like what's going on. If it's a ladies' meeting, I get think about ladies. If it's a bunch of drunken contractors having a cocktail party and they have a speech, they don't listen to good. So I always look at the crowd and I figure out the first joke, and I give them the meat and the subject, and then I finish up with heart.
You definitely had a talent for speaking to the public.
I like people. I don't have no animosity with any race, creed. I'm not mad at the government. I'm not mad at the lawyer. I'm not mad at the prison official. Life's too long not to enjoy yourself.
I haven't seen you in action. I ordered the videotape. I can't wait to watch it.
I sold 3 million copies of that, 1 million videos and films and DVD, and 2 million audio soundtracks, 5 languages.
So that's a whole publishing company. information products.
I published my last book, Turn It. We're out of print on that one.
You are. So you selling a lot of those books?
We sold them all, about 200,000.
Wow, you did?
I sold 7 million books in my career.
7 million books?
Yeah, most of them went for our distributorship.
Selling information products and training, I mean, there's good money in that as an income stream for a multi-level.
Well, it's good, but it's the hardest sale you'll ever make because most people spend about $8 on the attitude. They'll buy anything else but attitude. So that's why we use money to get them in. You can make money selling these courses, and then after they take the course, they don't care about making money. Selling courses, they can make money at the best gas station in town. All across America, my people, we're a million of them. They run the best gas station. They run the best taxi cab. They're the best husbands. They're the best wives because they know how to handle the attitude better.
How's the MLM industry today? What's your take on it?
It's all done by Internet. Most of the successful ones, Internet and fax machines. And phone conference.
Is it as big and as effective as ever?
Yes, bigger. You got over 8,000 companies out there.
So what are the stats now? What percent will be here in 5 years?
About 3% of the companies become an Amway type or Uskin Corporation out of Utah or Herbalife. They all had their legal problems. They just got through them and now they got board of directors. You got to pay the piper if you're going to last. In more ways than one, not just money-wise, but you got to have the right friends. Like a football team, you can't be a long runner no more. I was a long runner because I thought all you had to do was be honest.
Would you like to talk about anything that you'd like anyone to know about, any programs?
Selling my tapes on the Internet and website. I'm training for a company at the moment called Guaranteed International Travel.
So can you give your main website if anyone wanted to see some of this old footage of your speeches?
Glenn2n-turner.com.
Are you computer savvy, Glenn?
Not me. My wife is one of the geniuses on it. She has a genius IQ, Nancy Ann.
So what are you doing to keep busy today? You got existing companies right now.
I train people by phone and Internet. We do public speaking. I speak all over the country. I spoke for different companies.
What do you charge for, like, a keynote speech?
Depends on if it's local. If it's local, I'll do it maybe $5,000. If it's out to travel the day out, the day back, it's $10,000.
I saw you spoke to the Harvard Business School.
Business School of Law, and I spoke to Notre Dame.
So you spoke to all their law students?
In Notre Dame Marketing Business Class. That was the best.
What did you talk to him about?
Yeah, the standing ovation from Professor Yarnell's class. I talked to him about anybody can learn to market in school. What you got to do is learn how to handle people. And you got to be straight and honest because if you're honest, you can take people a little bit for the rest of their life. If you're dishonest, you take them one time, they wise up. If you give them a fair market value. The only way to do it is be honest. And if I've ever been dishonest, it came from my head, not my heart. The mistake I made, the government lawyer once told the jury, Mr. Turner might have meant to be honest. That he meant to run the red light, but in fact he run it. He still got to convict him even though he didn't mean to do anything wrong. That's the law. The Federal Trade Commission in 1972. And I said, please tell me what I'm doing wrong. And she asked your lawyer. I asked my lawyer, he said, you ain't doing nothing wrong. So I became a ping pong ball between two sets of lawyers. And then I looked at him and I said, if you'll send the lawyer down, he can sit at my desk. I get a big desk. I'll put another chair there. I'll pay his salary and he'll tell me if I'm doing anything wrong or daily. Well, we can't do that. I said, why can't you? Why ain't the law designed to help American people? And they wouldn't do it. They just wanted to bang me to get the publicity.
What would you tell the average guy who first comes across an MLM opportunity? What's important in an MLM opportunity?
I want to check out the credibility of the offering. Because if you got two or more running in you, you're going to have problems. Like Jay Van and Rich DeVos is the only one I ever seen. The partnership, it worked real good.
Are you saying because of the nature of partnerships, they usually go down?
Right. Your husband and wife go down, most of them.
Yep, that's true.
It ain't going to take no genius to figure that out.
How about compensation plans?
Compensation plans are important, but it's more important than the outline fail. Most people are too lazy to work after they get involved. You got to go on a stick, come hell, recession, depression, hot water, a war. Don't get involved. If you're going to give up before you start. Because there's going to be a million reasons you should give up, one reason you should stick. You got to realize that at multiple levels, you can go in business for a few $100s or nothing almost. You go into gas station business, 100 stations failed a month one time in Florida. And they didn't put them out of business. So there's Exxon, that's a big company.
What's the stats like with MLM? What percent really make any money in the business?
About 5%. 5% of people in the world make things happen. 15% of people watch what happens. And the 80%. I don't know what in hell happens here, as long as they got a beer and a woman. The beer gets stale, the woman gets old. But the point is, I've never been stuck with any product. What's sold to me, I'm going to sell somebody else. If they work the retail part, they can make it. And everybody's a salesman, so they sell their wives, don't marry them. They sell their husbands, don't marry them. They're really a good salesman.
For more information on any of Glenn Turner's products, please email me at michael@hardtofindseminars.com. In the subject line of the email, write Glenn Turner, and I will provide you with some information on how you can get more products by Glenn Turner.